We are now a little less than 2 weeks from Christmas. Those that celebrate it would tell you that it's a time of joy, of peace, of goodwill towards men. As you go into the stores and the various businesses, you'll hear people wishing each other Merry Christmas. But I want to ask you a question. Do we live in a time of joy? Do we live in a time of peace and goodwill towards our fellow man? Thankfully, some few do still live by that, not just at Christmas time, but throughout the year. But for the majority, people are out to get what they can for themselves. It's not a matter of goodwill towards your fellow man. So the stark reality is that we don't live in a time of joy, a time of peace, a time of goodwill towards one another. We live in a world that is filled with misery. The message that travels with Christmas is a mask for the true reality within our world. It is a mask from the true reality of our world. Real words that describe our world, and not just at Christmas time, but year-round, are pain, unhappiness, and misery for far too many people in this world today. And by a great extent, those of us in the United States live sheltered from the reality of the rest of the world. That's just the facts. And it is a blessing. It is a blessing by the hand of God. And I think that our country and the state of atmosphere that we live in, although it's far from perfect, is a blessing from God. And it is here because His hand has said it so. The title for my sermon today is, Are We Living in Reality? Are we living in reality? As we get into the sermon, I want to ask you to consider just a few of the headlines that I pulled off of some of the major network news sites that are on the internet. It was just a few. Really, the list could have been endless. But if I stay more than an hour, you're going to run me out of here soon. But consider just these few headlines from this week's news. Accused Seattle campus killer, and this happened back in June of this year, confessed how it was so much fun, he said, as he opened fire on college campus kids. He said it was so much fun. He ended up killing one person and injuring two others. And he thought that it was just fun taking a gun and start gunning down innocent people. An ISIS militant that has been held captive by the Kurds recently admitted to taking 70 innocent lives. 70 lives. It was just one person a part of ISIS. There was another story in the news that I saw this week. A story of an innocent girl whose death is too gruesome for me to describe here at services. An 8-year-old girl. And unfortunately, her circumstances were not uncommon. This happens even, and it was in our country, and it happens repeatedly from time to time in our country. Horrible things happening to small children in our country. A lot of evil brought upon children in our country. Many of you may have heard the next headline because it really did make big headlines this week. If you're watching the news, and it was ISIS militants beheaded 4 Christian children this week, all under the age of 15 years old. And as I read the story, the details that they were giving out was, I guess these, I don't know if you want to call them soldiers or not, these militants went into one or two homes, saw these kids, went up to the kids, and they knew that this family or these children were believers in Jesus Christ. and they told the children, denounce Jesus Christ. And they refused and they said, no, we love Yahshua. And they immediately beheaded the four children. I also saw within the last couple of days this week a story about a 19-year-old young lady who was set on fire and left to die a burning death. What goes into the state of mind of a person to come up with that idea and think, I'll show him or her? Was it a revenge killing? Was it just for the kicks of it, like this Seattle killer where he said it was just so much fun? Either way, it's sick, it's deprived, and it's a sad state and commentary on our society today. Certainly not a world of joy, peace, and goodwill towards our fellow man. That's just the tip of the iceberg of the evils that I read about, not throughout the entire year, not for over a 10-year span, just this past week. Things that came out. These are just a few of the many horrific evils that take place every day, every week, every month, every year in this world. And unfortunately, there's many more that never make the national news headlines that are just as horrific. Man has no answer to stop the endless crimes against itself. There are no answers for mankind to stop it, to change the way man is heading, to give them a different heart. And these events that I just read about make the words from God delivered to us by Paul become even more real. Let's turn, if you would, to Romans chapter 8. Verse 19. Romans chapter 8. We'll read verses 19 through 22. Verse 19, Paul says, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. That earnest expectation can also mean the intense anticipation. That there is an intense anticipation for the waiting and the revealing of the sons of God. That's what this world is going through. An intense anticipation for Jesus Christ's return and for his plan to be revealed, to begin the plan of salvation, of changing the ruler of this world. Verse 20, for the creation was subject to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. In other words, there's been a curse placed on this world, not to bring the world to an end, but to give us hope of something better. And that curse happened when mankind decided to reject the rulership of God and instead accepted the rulership of Satan on this earth. We don't have time to go back and to look at it, but it's in the first couple chapters of Genesis. Because of man's rebellion, because of man's rejection of God and his rulership and his government on this earth, God said, okay, you have the government of Satan to live within. And that's what we do to this day. Verse 21, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption. It's talking about that hope that it just mentioned in verse 20. Delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. That's you and I. There's going to come a time when things change. And there'll no longer be the headlines that I just read. Verse 22, for we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Or up until now. and it's continued to our day as well. And in fact, it's even gotten worse. With our mass media and connections around the world that were not there at the time of Jesus Christ, we're much more aware of the extent of the evil in this world today than they were at Christ's time. And it's tough. It's tough to see it every day, to see and to hear horrible things happening to children and to innocent people. College students that are going about their day and all of a sudden get gunned down. That young lady that was set on fire and died because of that. They had film footage just an hour before that where she was in a gas station from one of the security cameras. This world is crying out for Jesus Christ to return and establish His Father's government on this earth. That is the only answer, and that is the only hope. But what about us? What about us as the children of God that Paul talks about in Romans? Are we crying out? Do we see these things take place day in and day out and then fall on our knees to God and shed tears for this world and the evil that comes upon them? Do we have that intense anticipation for the return of Jesus Christ? Are we experiencing empathy towards this world and the pain that it suffers? And we're not excluded from it. It brings the pain and the suffering that's in this world affects God's people, and it affects those that aren't God's people. We're all in the same boat, so to speak. This is what I would like to talk about today. Let's go to Romans, just to the next verse, actually. Romans chapter 8, verse 23. Paul goes on and says, not only that, speaking of the world and that's crying out and the pains and the suffering that it's going through, Paul says, not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. Paul says we're all in the same boat together. We all are groaning and suffering together because of the curse and the evil government that rules this earth. But there is one big difference, and it is a very big difference between us and the rest of the world as we endure the same pain and the same suffering from time to time. We know the answer to the question, why? That makes a big difference. We understand the why of what takes place in this world when we see the evil. We have the answers of what is taking place in this world. And it gives us the hope that there's going to be a change on the horizon. This world doesn't have the answer. When they see these same headlines, they sometimes, some people just callously and turn away from it and ignore it. Others do shed tears, especially when these pains and these sufferings hit directly to them at home. But they don't have the answers to why. I received a call last night from a lady who has attended a couple services with us, and when I say us, I mean the United Church of God, not anywhere near locally here. She was trying to actually reach a minister up in her area, which is up in Michigan, and she couldn't get a hold of the minister. So from the little bit of conversation we had regarding her efforts, it sounded like she called back to the home office and asked for another phone number of another minister, and they just happened to route her to me. And I called her back, and she and I spoke for over an hour. But her first her first comments to me when I finally was able to speak to her on the phone was she said, "This time of year, Christmas is so hard." She's a single lady. She's divorced from her husband. She has a 21-year-old son. And she told me, she went on for at least 45 minutes about her frustration in trying to connect with her 21-year-old son. She spoke about the frustration and the pain and the suffering that she's endured over years of abuse and neglect and unfaithfulness from her ex-husband. And I just sat and listened, and my heart ached for her because she was hurting so much because of the sins that take place on a daily basis around this world. And they were hitting her right between the eyes. And she had no answers. She didn't know why it was taking place. She went on and explained to me that she could see her neighbors that were not religious people. And she said, they prosper. She said, why do they prosper? And I had to explain to her that this is not God's world. And she said, what? I said, they prosper because this is not God's world. This is not a world of justice. Evil happens and evil prospers in this world. And I talked to her and we looked at a few scriptures. I talked to her about Job. And she said, well, I thought God was in charge. I said, God is in charge, but his government is not on this earth. And I showed her how Satan went before God's throne and asked for permission to bring trials and suffering upon Job. But I said, God gave him specific restrictions on what he was allowed to do and what he was allowed not to do. And I showed those instances to her. We also talked about how man rejected God back in Genesis. And I told her that there's a big difference between good in the world, because she said that she could see that there were good people in the world. I said, there's a big difference between good in the world and righteousness that leads to life. And we talked about the two trees, and that God said that there was a tree that leads to righteousness, a tree of life. And the path that leads to life is righteousness, of obedience to God. I said, people prosper, but they're not living their life in obedience to God, are they? And she said, no, they're not. She's went to a number of different churches trying to find answers. And she said she went into, I won't say the denomination because I may even have it wrong, but she went into a church that observed the Sabbath. And she got in there and they were celebrating Christmas, and she said they were eating wrong foods. And she said, she thought to herself, this is not right. She said, they're just doing whatever they want to do in their worship to God. I said, yes, unfortunately, that's the focus of most of Christianity today. But she didn't have answers. She didn't have answers. And it made a little more sense to her. She said, I've never really considered that Satan was actually in control of the world. And we went into Matthew and we talked about how Satan took Jesus Christ up on a high mountain and offered him all of the world. I said, you can't offer something that you don't have ownership of. I said, he knew, and Jesus Christ never said, you don't own this, you can't give this to me. That was never a part of that conversation. Satan had ownership of the world. And he was putting it before Jesus Christ. He said, why wait thousands of years before you return to take ownership of this world when I can give it to you now? All you have to do is bow down and worship. Thankfully, Jesus Christ wasn't into fast food. Because that's really what Satan was offering him. But this woman who had just a little bit of connection with the church, just a little bit. She said she'd been to services a couple times, was struggling. She was crying out. She was frustrated. And she's really one of the fortunate ones because God has given her access, at least now at this point in her life, to understanding the reasons why. She's got a long way to go. But so many people are just like her. And they don't know where to turn. And they don't know where to get the answers. When you see the world suffer at the hand of evil, what do you think? Do we just turn away and think about other things? Do we ignore the headlines, not even turn to the local and national and world news affiliates? Do we avoid the pain that is there in our world every day? Are we callous towards the evils in this world and the hurts of the people in this world? Those are questions that we all need to ask ourselves. As we go through the sermon today, I want to cover a few real life stories that very poignantly paint the dark state of our world today and the suffering of the people in it. We'll see that even though this world doesn't understand the complete plan of God, there's still a powerful and real hope for each and every person in this world. I really have 2 points for the sermon today. The first one is, open your heart to this world. Open your heart to this world. I think I gave the title, didn't I? Are we living in reality? The first point, though, is open your heart to this world. What do I mean by this? It means to allow your heart to be filled with compassion towards a world that suffers every day at the hand of Satan. Allow your heart to be opened up to the compassion and have compassion for the people that suffer in this world every day. Our Father's heart is wide open to all the people in this world. Those that He has opened the minds to, the first fruits, and all of the world. He loves us and them on the same level. We all are called and worked with by God in His time according to His schedule. But His love for this world is no less than it is for each and every one of us. Let's turn to John chapter 3, verse 12. Might have thought we were going to talk about Christmas when I started this sermon. Not so much. At least not direct. John chapter 3, beginning in verse 12, it says, "If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" He's saying you need to believe the small physical things that I'm telling you, and then there's a hope that you'll believe the heavenly spiritual things. No one has ascended to heaven, but He who came down from heaven, that is the Son of Man who is in heaven. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have eternal life. That word believe has a very distinct meaning. It means to trust your whole life in Jesus Christ. It's not just a thought. It's not just a thought. To believe in Jesus Christ and the purpose of His life and the purpose of His death and the purpose of His eternal life is to put your entire trust in the salvation that He offers you. That whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have eternal life. It says, "For God so loved the world." It doesn't say, for God so loved those that he's called, or those that are the first fruits. He loves the whole world. And he gave his only begotten son, that whoever, again, trusts with their every ounce of their being or believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world. He condemns their actions, but not the people. But that the world through him might be saved. That paints a pretty good picture of God the Father and Jesus Christ's attitude towards all of his creation on this earth. There's a story I found online this week, and actually this lady posted on December 5th. It was just a blog site where you can post your ideas and your feelings or whatever thoughts you have going, and it was a fairly short post, and I want to read it to you. She titles it Midlife Crisis, and she actually has two mids there. I'm not sure what that is intending, maybe a little bit beyond midlife, I guess. But she says, midlife crisis. And it was written by a Ms. Morgan, and again on December 5th. And it was, posted on a website called Sunny Skies. She says, did you ever wish you could hear God's voice like Samuel did when he was under the tutelage of Eli? She said, I sure have. I have so many questions about life. What is my purpose here? Who am I to become? Am I on the right path to happiness? She goes on, she says, recently I've also been questioning where I am in my life right now. Being a prisoner of my thoughts, which I thought that was an interesting comment. She said, being a prisoner of my thoughts, I often find myself locked up behind bars of emotional turmoil and disappointment. Why? Because she doesn't have the answers to those questions. She feels like a prisoner because she's got all these questions that mean so much to her, and yet she can't figure out how to get the answers. She goes on, she said, I just thought I would have accomplished a lot more at this age. One day, in my mind, I solemnly said, God, what? Am I supposed to be worried? Because she was full of worry, full of concern in her life. That's just one of the examples, again, of so many questions in the world's mind of why. Why am I here? What is the purpose? Am I heading in the right direction? Why is there so much evil? Why are innocent people being killed daily? Why are those that are the most depraved prospering and getting away with it? A lot of questions of why. Someday she'll have the answers to her questions. And God does hear her prayer. And his answers back to her are, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to wait to find those answers. We all need to wait for different things in our life. Wait on God. Wait according to his schedule, because it is all for our goodwill, no matter what we're facing. This world needs our prayers. God hears you. It's his promise to you and I that he hears the prayers of the righteous. We need to remember those in this world that are fighting horrible battles against sin and evil in their life, and all out of frustration because they don't have the answers. We need to pray for this world on at least a regular basis. Prayers of mercy for them in their ignorance because Satan has blinded their minds to the understanding and abuses that he pours upon them in his evil. We are not to be of the world, but the world is also not our enemy. We have one common enemy. God's people and this world have one common enemy, and it's not each other. It's Satan. He pours out his evil upon you and I and upon this world every day. Our hearts need to be filled with compassion upon those that desire to see but simply cannot. They desire it. There are people out there that want answers so bad, but they can't see them. Let's go to John chapter 9, verse 1. There's a story here about Jesus healing a man who was blind from birth. Let's notice especially some of Jesus Christ's comments when we get there. John chapter 9, verse 1 says, "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned?" So they just assumed that if this man is blind, he must have done something wrong, he or his ancestors. "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus answered, verse 3. Notice Christ's comments here. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." He was blind so that others could see the works of God done in him. Jesus Christ is saying, notice what my works are. Notice what my Father's works are. This person, as far as we know, was not a converted person. As far as we know, we don't know if he was keeping the Sabbath, God's holy days. We don't know anything about him. But the indication is that he probably wasn't. He was just a blind man that was there along the road that they were traveling. Verse 4, Christ said, "I must work the works of him," speaking of his Father, "who sent me while it is day." What is he getting ready to do? What are the works of his Father that he must do? "The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." And the rest of the story, which we won't go into, he goes in, takes a little mud, a little spit, and gives the man some instructions, rubs it on his eyes, and he heals this man from his blindness. What are the works of God the Father and Jesus Christ bringing healing to this world? God the Father and Jesus Christ, their whole focus, their whole work is to bring healing. And Jesus Christ said, while I am physical and I'm walking this earth, this world has light. They have healing. Because that's what Jesus Christ did in his ministry. He went around and healed people, forgave them of their sins, gave them healing spiritually, gave them healing physically. But he knew his time on this earth was going to be short, didn't he? And he said, while I am here, this world has light, it has healing. But there's going to come a day when you're not going to have it. We live in that day now. We live in the day of darkness upon this earth. It is not the government of God the Father or Jesus Christ on this earth. Jesus Christ is back with his Father on his throne. But when he was here, there was healing. It is the work of the Father and of Jesus Christ And it is what is going to come to this earth when Jesus Christ returns again. When Jesus Christ returns in the future, light will be restored to this dark earth and healing will begin. And it'll be real and it will affect everyone. But in the meantime, we need to see that we live within a very dark world that is not offered healing at this time. Our hearts should be praising God daily in anticipation in appreciation for our spiritual insight. We need to be giving thanks to God that we have the answers to the whys. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 13, verse 13. Matthew chapter 13, verses 13 through 17. Verse 13, Jesus Christ speaking says, "Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand." This world doesn't have the concept or the ability to understand. "And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, 'Hearing you will hear and shall not understand, seeing you will see and not perceive, for the hearts of this people have grown dull, their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed. Lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them.'" You see, you and I have already been a part of God's graciousness and His work, which is healing. You and I have been healed to understand, given that ability to understand. God's work and Jesus Christ's work is all about bringing healing to a world that suffers under the curse and the government of Satan. And He said it Himself that if they were to understand and turn from their ways, He says, so that I should heal them. That's the process. Verse 16, "But blessed are your eyes, for they see." He's speaking to you and to me. "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it." We should be going to God on a regular basis and giving Him thanks, showing our deepest appreciation for what He has done for us, for our healing. The second point of the sermon today is recognize your callousness. Recognize your callousness. I needed help spelling this, so maybe somebody else does. It's C-A-L-L-O-U-S. C-A-L-L-O-U-S-N-E-S. Recognize your callousness. Maybe you think that you're not callous to this world's problems. Well, let's do a little test. Turn with me, if you would, to Psalms chapter 69, verses 1 and 2. Psalm 69, verses 1 and 2. "Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in deep mire, where there is no standing. I have come into deep waters, where the floods overflow me. Now turn to Psalms 102. Think about those words. Psalm 102, verse 3. We'll read verses 3 through 9 of Psalm 102. For my days are consumed like smoke. Think about the adjectives. Think about the picture that is being painted here from this psalmist. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned like a hearth. My heart is stricken and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. But because of the sound of my groaning, my bones cling to my skin. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I lie awake, and I am like a sparrow alone on the housetop. My enemies reproach me all day long. Those who deride me swear an oath against me, for I have eaten ashes like bread and mingled my drink with weeping or with my tears. Quite a descriptive psalm, actually two psalms that we read, and there's many, those are just a sample, of a lament from an individual that was under extreme mourning and suffering. And here's my question. Can you relate to the words that he's expressing? I can't. I've never reached a point in my life in terms of mourning to where I could take a pen and paper and I could write down a description of my inner feelings to that degree. And I think there's a reason why I can't. And that's because I've never allowed myself to be touched so deep in my life that I feel that much sorrow. There's a need for us to feel that much sorrow. There's a need for us to be open in our heart like the psalmists were. To be able to feel so much the evil that is around us. And then to fall down on your knees and to pour it out to God. That's the whole point of the Psalms. The Psalms are giving us a description of what a true open heart is all about in your relationship with God. To be able to look around you and see the evil and the suffering that goes on daily to you or to your friends or to your family members or to this world as a whole, and to feel it to your bones. Then as you feel it, you don't bottle it up. You take it before God's merciful throne and you pour it back out to Him in prayer, offering it up to Him, asking for help, telling Him how you feel. So why are we callous? And you can answer this for yourself. I'm not trying to label anybody here. I'm actually speaking for myself. So why do we have this callousness? It's because we don't want to feel the pain. We want to turn away from it. We don't want to hear about the little 8-year-old girl that's getting ravaged, or the young lady that's just exiting her teen years being set on fire. We don't want to think those things exist. We want to push away from it and close ourselves up. That's not what we're called to do. You see, because God and Jesus Christ feel those people's pain. Jesus Christ said he was very much acquainted with suffering. He knew how to fall down on his knees and pour his heart out to his Father, as we heard in the sermonette from Mr. McNeely. He did it. He spoke that way to his Father, praying and asking, if this could possibly pass from me, please let it be so. And you can bet that that was not a casual plea to his Father. We as God's people need to be able to open our heart and to let the grief of what's going on in this world come in, and then at the same time, think about it, meditate on it, think about how it works out in God's plan, think about what the hope is when you experience this kind of grief, and put it back out to God. And what happens when you do? When you take in the grief and the suffering that's around you that is reality, and you bring it into your life, and you deal with it on a conscious level, and then you fall down before God and you pour it back out of your life to Him, as the psalmist did, time and time again, what comes back in to fill you up? The joy of God's plan. Because having the knowledge that God has given you and I, you can't fall down on your knees, pour out your grief to God, and not at the same time say, well, I know the answers to why. And I know the hope that has been given to me and to this whole world. So when we bottle ourselves up and we become callous to this world and we turn our eyes away from the evil that goes on, we don't allow the joy of the hope of God to have its full work in our life. I'm currently reading a book called Deeper Places, written by Matthew Jacoby, and it talks about the book of Psalms. It's an excellent book, and I'm not a big reader. Some people just read, read, read. My son is that way. I'm not a big reader. Matthew Jacoby is a minister. He's also, you probably heard about his Christian band. It's called Sons of Korah. But I want to read a part of what he has to say in this book. He's talking about the Psalms and how the psalmists are at a point of lament, of lamenting the evil and the things that are going on around them and in their life. And he begins here, he says, these expressions of grief and pain, and many others like them in the book of Psalms, are not self-indulgent wallowing in misery. He said, that's not the point of them, just wallowing in misery. You look at those and you don't give any thought to the Psalms, and you think, you know, these people, they just really had a rough way to go. He says, the full expression of grief is vital for moving out of grief. Grief must be exhausted in order to be alleviated. The use of metaphor is common throughout the Psalms, and not least in the Lament Psalms, where it is a vital part of the catharsis of grieving. The lamenting psalmists use the imaginary of drowning, of being surrounded by beasts, of being emptied like a jar, of melting like wax, and of burning like embers to describe how they feel. There is a healing effect, an expression. The grief of the psalmist was expressed like this, not primarily for the benefit of someone else, but for the exhaustion of grief itself. And yet there is indeed great benefit for us all in these expressions. The lament psalms provide an emphatic touchstone for those who suffer in the same way. They not only give us permission to grieve, but also encourage us to express our grief fully before God. As we do this, we can begin to appropriate the compassion of the God who is no stranger to suffering. In this way, the psalmists show us how to suffer. They call us to cry on God's shoulder and exhaust our grief in the presence of the most empathetic listener in the universe. And He is. He is there for you and I. The next section is titled The Optimism of Sadness. It says the lament psalms demonstrate an optimistic realism. They demonstrate a sober acquaintance with the harshest realities of the world, and yet they are by no means pessimistic as a result of this acknowledgement. Pessimism is the attitude of hopelessness. You see, the psalmists that go through their laments are not pessimistic. You can't sit there and say, well, they just have a rotten view of the world. That's not the case. They have they're living in reality. And they're not blocking it out. They've opened their heart to receive it in, and then they pour it back to God in prayer. It is the belief that nothing will ever get better. That is a pessimistic view. If I am told by my doctor that I am overweight and in danger of heart disease, I would not call him a pessimist, and I would not be a pessimist for recognizing that fact. If I wallow in despair, believing that there's no way to change the situation, then I would be a pessimist. But if I, in response to my doctor's diagnosis, begin to change my diet and exercise, then I demonstrate that a reality check can do wonderful things to motivate us to seek a solution to our problem. An optimism that will not face reality is only delusion. Think about that. I'm going to read it again. An optimism, and we in the church are optimistic because we see the hope of God's kingdom. It says an optimism that will not face reality is only delusion. We have to make sure that we are facing reality. But to face reality and nevertheless believe that there is a solution is the most powerful form of optimism. This is the optimism of faith, a faith that is expressed in the Psalms. The laments are not just expressions of grief, they are expressions of grief before God. This is the key. As we open our hearts to let out the pain, we thereby also open our hearts to receive consolation, and our consolation is God's preoccupation with restoration, which are a lot of big words for saying God's work is healing. That is His work. We should feel the pain of others when we see it, just as Jesus Christ did and still does today. Let's turn to Mark chapter 1, verse 40. Christ comes upon a leper here. A leper suffers with his problems every day. Cannot see the end of his problems. Matthew chapter 1, verse 40 says, now a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him, and saying to him, if you are willing, you can make me clean. What a statement to Jesus Christ. If you are willing. Then Jesus moved with compassion. He felt his heart just open up to this individual. Stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I am willing, be cleansed. See, Jesus Christ was saying back to him, I am willing to heal you. I want and desire greatly to heal you. John chapter 9. Actually, we covered this one. Skip through that. I want to now talk about another very sad catastrophe that is happening to this world, going on as we know it. It's been in the headlines on numerous occasions. And it has to do with the dreadful disease of Ebola. I've got an article before me. It was written by the BBC, BBC News Magazine, and it was an article dated December 10th, so just a few days ago. It's entitled, My Fight Against the Invisible Enemy. It says, healthcare workers fighting Ebola have been named as Time's Person of the Year. The healthcare workers, not just one individual, but all of them that are fighting this dreadful disease. They've been named Person of the Year. And one face splashed on covers of the magazine is that of an ambulance driver. His name is Foday, it's spelled F-O-D-A-Y, Galla, G-A-L-L-A-H, Foday Galla, in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Here he tells the BBC of his determination to battle a disease which almost killed him. He starts his story. In August, I went to pick up a little 4-year-old boy from his home. I knew the place well. I had already taken 7 members of his family who all eventually died. He was the last one. I hadn't taken him before because he had showed no symptoms. But I had asked the neighbors to keep an eye on him and to call me if he got sick. On the afternoon of the morning that I took his father and grandmother and brothers, I got the call. I drove straight to his home and I saw the boy lying in a pool of vomit. I picked him up and I was carrying him in my arms to the ambulance when he vomited again onto my chest. As it turned out, my protective suit was not completely sealed, but in that moment I was very focused on what I was doing, getting him to the Medicines Sans Frontières treatment center as quickly as possible. The following Saturday, I went down with a fever. I gave myself some medications, but the fever wouldn't break. I told my family to stay away from me, and the following day I went to a treatment center to be tested. I had known I would get it eventually. A lot of great doctors and nurses on the front lines have died. They tried to be careful, but Ebola still got them. And I might just add, so far this year, over 6,000 people over in those 3 countries in Africa have died from Ebola. Many more have been sickened by it. But over 6,000 have died so far in the year of 2014. I'll back up a little bit. He said, I had known I would get it eventually. A lot of great doctors and nurses on the front lines have died. They tried to be careful, but Ebola still got them. I had carried so many patients in my ambulance and seen so many die in my arms. I was frightened, but I prayed. And God didn't allow my fears to take over. You don't want to know what Ebola feels like. If you're not psychologically strong and God is not on your side, you will drop before you are taken for treatment because the pain is too great. You have no appetite. Nothing stays in your system. You vomit a lot. And you are dehydrated. And then comes the diarrhea. It's bad. Terrible. Devastating. It makes you want to give up on life. All I wanted was to be looked at, cared for, shown love. And I was shown a lot of love and concern and care by the doctors and nurses who treated me. I was there for 2 weeks. In the same tent as me in the treatment center, a 2-month-old baby died from the disease. And I lay listening to a lady who cried out until she died. But the little boy who had infected me was there too, and he survived. I don't know why I survived. Maybe it was because of my faith in God. or maybe just because I went for treatment promptly. And thank God my family did not stigmatize me. They were scared, my mother and my brother, but they never turned their backs on me, and that was the same with my boss, Honorable Joseph. They all built me up and gave me courage. I want people to know that Ebola is not necessarily a death sentence and you can survive it. I went back to my job part-time at the beginning of December. I have some immunity to the disease now, but I still wear protective clothes. I was always kind to my patients, but my experience made me double my effort with them. So now I talk to them when they are in my ambulance to keep their hopes alive. I tell them, look, you're not going to die. We're going to get you to the treatment center. Remember to listen to the doctors there. Take their advice. Take your medication. You are going to be okay, and you're going to go back to your family. In February, before the Ebola virus, our job involved going to communities to pick up pregnant women, accident victims, and patients with hypertension. Now, ambulance crews are working 24 hours a day. When people are dying, you need to be all over the city. It's hectic. Our workload is tripled, and we don't have enough ambulances in Monrovia to deal with the disease. Recently, I transported 11 people from the Omega area, and they all died. Sometimes I feel so sad. When I'm looking at someone and I know that he or she is dying, sometimes I just want to give up. Most of my friends now stay away from me because of my job. Some of them talk to me on the phone, but they won't see me in person. Many of the patients I pick up are afraid. Some of them just cry. They cry because of the pain, but also because their families have deserted them. I remember a 70-year-old lady. When we got up to her house, she was all alone in this 4-bedroom apartment. Her children, gone. Her husband, gone. All of her family members, gone. And she was alone and shivering. I could see death in her eyes. My colleague and I picked her up, took her to the ambulance, and we nearly died of suffocation that day in our protective suits. It's another example of the realities of this world. Only by the grace of God is it not in our world. We should not close our heart off to it. This world is crying out for help. It needs help. And someday that help is going to come. The title for my sermon is, Are We Living in Reality? This world is not living in reality. What is real about the Christmas season? Nothing is real about the Christmas season. What is real about the few news headlines that we have looked at today? Everything is real about the news headlines that we've read today. God the Father, do we feel reality? God the Father does. Jesus Christ did as he walked this earth. He called his healings the work of his Father. There's coming a day when the light will be with us again, but it's not right now. This time, it will be here to stay, or when it comes, it will be here to stay, and it will be a time of great healing, a time of great joy. Let's turn to a final scripture, Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 6. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 6. Behold, I will bring it, health and healing. I will heal them and reveal to them the abundance of peace and truth. It's not talking about our world now. It's talking about the time when Jesus Christ will come back to this earth, will dethrone Satan, remove His government from this earth and replace the evil with healing. Skip on down to verse 8. He says, I will cleanse them from all their iniquity by which they have sinned against me, and I will pardon all of their iniquities by which they have sinned and by which they have transgressed against me. Verse 14. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will perform that good thing which I have promised to the house of Israel and to the house of Judah. There are promises, and that day is coming. We have the assurance of the hope that God has given each of every one of us. He's opened our eyes, and He has cleared our ears so that we can see and hear and understand the hope. We have the answers to why. That time is not upon us yet. For now, we must learn to live within reality. A time to feel the pain, really feel it. To open our hearts and to fill our hearts with the compassion and the compassion that Christ and the Father has towards this world. Open your hearts. Let in the pain and the suffering that is in this world. Then pour them back out to God in grief. Put your head on our Father's shoulder. Pray for His kingdom to come, which we're instructed to do. And then once you've done that, fill that emptiness with the hope and the joy of the plan of God. The hope and assurance that one day, it will all be over. Over for once and for all. Rejoice in the rest of the Sabbath day.